We are in the top 10. Yes. North South Connection Podcast Network, welcome to another episode of The Year That Was, which is the podcast that is ranking every single WWE, as Michael Cole will say, year from worst to best. My God, we started last year with now our 36th best year of professional wrestling in the WWE, which was 1995. And my God, here we are, episode 26, almost a year later, and we're breaking through the top 10. And I'm going to be honest. My name's Aaron, if you're joining us for the first time. Sorry, I never introduced myself, but I'm assuming that the audience isn't actually growing. It's just the same people, which I'm extremely grateful for. So thank you for listening, and just know I truly appreciate you. That's not just a catchphrase. Like, I find myself just baffled that anyone wants to listen to this. So if you are, and you're sharing it, and you're talking about it, and you reach out to me, you're in my heart. All right, look, these years, so we're doing 2018 today. And these are the years, honestly, I struggle the most with. I find that with a few exceptions, from 2016 to 2019, feels like kind of one big blur. And it might be because of the homogeneity of the product, or maybe it's because it's those 4 years that like that really bombard you with content. To give you some context, a year like 2018... like when I was watching these, right? Because I watched them. I mean, this is not obviously, I wasn't taking notes in 2018. Perhaps I should have. But I would watch a whole year straight, right? That's how I would do this project. That's how I'm able to compare the matches against each other. Like, for instance, right now I'm watching 2021 and there's no chance. I'm not going back. But I can't compare the matches against each other. So there'll be probably something different for 2021. But so I'm watching them like straight back to back to back to back to back. And a year like 2018 will generally take me about a month to get through. Whereas a year like, say, 1995 takes me about a week, sometimes less, you know? And yes, the shows are longer, but there's an element that I have to psych myself up to watch these shows. You know, like, do I really want to watch another 4 hours of the Saudi Arabian propaganda, right? And I guess if I want to be a completist, and I am, I have to sit through, like, these attraction matches that involve Triple H, The Undertaker, Kane, and Shawn fucking Michaels in 2018. So it's like, for every Ronda Rousey match that surprises and delights, there's a Nia Jax match, which feels about 50 steps backwards. And I find the Saudi and the Australian show this year make it difficult. I mean, that's a combined 12 hours, roughly, that has no impact on the product besides reinforcing the egos of the legends involved. The other problem is the constant rematches. And I feel you really feel this in 2018. And because they don't use the rematches to kind of push the storyline further, you might as well not have them. If you just took each pairing's best match and do six great shows, until instead of like dragging these feuds out like they're fucking Dick Clark every year, can we just not let Dick Clark die? He's dead now, right? But do we have to keep dragging his ass out and watching him painfully stumble through the sheer terror of his life slowly ending? Sorry, I shouldn't be getting fired up. I don't know why I'm negative about the 10th best year in WWE history. NXT, obviously a force again this year. The women's division reached its zenith. And WWE were given all the work rate dream matches they could ask for. And yet, I find it funny that, like, if I were to mention 2018 is the 10th best year, most people, I think, would probably be surprised. Let's find out why, all right? Thanks for joining us on Monday, by the way. I know this is dropping on a Monday. On alternate Mondays, you're getting Now Entering the Royal Rumble, which is on the North-South Connection Podcast Network, which is a breakdown, myself and JT. We're breaking down every single competitor that's ever been in the Royal Rumble. We started from the first ever person, which was Bret Hart. We worked our way through 1988. And we're on to 89 now, but when we do a guy, we do his whole run. So Bret Hart, there were five Rumbles to talk about. Our most recent episode dealt with Andre the Giant. And next week, you're getting a bit of a treat. I felt it was a treat anyway, because we're dealing with Mr. Perfect, Rugged Ronnie Garvin, and Greg the Hammer Valentine. So ignore that computer sound that just came out, because I just don't want to edit it out, right? But let's get back to 2018. A couple through lines that I was thinking about. So... I don't remember anything. Like, I have an idea of what happened, But, like, I can't tell you match specifics of anything besides the women. I also think that 2018 gives us a trope of WWE that I really don't like. I actually think this is worst trope of giving us lesser versions of matches that have happened in other promotions. So you're going to see this come up a few times, and it hurts. But this is something they still do today. That being said, the in-ring quality in general is really great. And the women carry the year. So if you're just joining us, we rank the years, or I rank the years, I guess, in 12 categories and then give it a score. The first category we rank it on is match quality. And this finished fifth out of 36. So this is a very match quality driven driven year, right? It's also 153 matches in this year, which is far and away more than any pay-per-view year we've ever done. And I don't think we'll ever do that again, hopefully. Between NXT and the Saudi Arabian shows and regular shows, there are 20 pay-per-views in 2018, most of which clock in at 4 hours. And look, the match quality is clearly good. It finished fifth, right? That's good. The average star rating for the year I had at 3.12. I have 31 four-star matches, which is incredible and the most of any year. 20% of the matches are great. 59% or at least good. These are very good statistics for the year. This is its strength. This is its bread and butter, as they say. 13 of the top 20 matches are from NXT, though. 4 of the top 5. And while I think it's easy to be a bit dismissive of the great matches we did get on the main roster, I wonder if we view them, and this is something I think about, I wonder if we view them as lesser because we're comparing them to the NXT shows that are like next level stuff, right? So it's like, is every Shinsuke Nakamura match compared to his first match with Sami Zayn? Is that fair? Maybe it is fair, right? Like, if you can do that, why can't you do it every time? Or even, I mean, if you think about it closer, like, it's like, is the Shinsuke Nakamura AJ Styles match at WrestleMania, is it fair to compare it to the Johnny Gargano Tommaso Ciampa match? Or even the ladder match? Or any of the matches that take over New Orleans? I think it's fair, but then maybe it gives us a different view of how good that match actually is because we're getting a direct comparison to something that's next level. One of the problems this year has, though, is when the matches are bad in 2018, they're often long and they involve people that have moved on to be mayors. And unless your name is Mike Hagar, you have no business stepping into the ring if you're the mayor of a town. Okay. And I'm sorry. So I looked at I'm going to be honest with you here, okay? And I mean, full transparency. Normally I watch the worst match of the year to kind of give you an idea of, you know, where I'm at, what I think about it. Often, honestly, it's because I don't really remember the match that well. And then this one I remembered well, but I was going to watch it anyways. I just loaded it up on my WWE Network, which I'm still able to get for some reason. And then I saw it was 40 minutes, and I'm like, fuck this. I can't do it. The worst match of the year. So let me give you the second worst match of the year, all right, is The Undertaker versus Triple H, no DQ, from Super Showdown, right? I have it at 0.5 stars. It's 28 minutes of these two in 2018. It's like 6 years after their, I don't even say their prime, but like where they had their one of their best matches. It's too long. And 28 minutes? I'm happy if you're in Australia and you enjoyed the show, but like, Jesus Christ. And then the worst match of the year is, well, it's obvious what it is. It's D-Generation X reunited versus the Brothers of Destruction from Crown Jewel. And it's the same time. It's 28 minutes. 28 minutes with Kane, who doesn't wrestle anymore, and Shawn Michaels, who hasn't wrestled in 8 years. And Shawn Michaels is the best person in the match. It makes no sense that they made this match, and I guess it makes sense. Money, you know, money wins the day, right? But this match was just a mess. Yes, Triple H got hurt early, but honestly, if he'd been in it the whole time, would it be any better? Really? Would it really be any better? It was half a star. I have this at 0 stars. It was half a star better with him and The Undertaker. But then you throw in Kane and Shawn. I mean, like, I'm not going to shit on Shawn Michaels. He really did okay in the match. I think I've heard him regret that he came out of retirement for it. There's even a moment where he turns to Triple H and says, we're too old for this shit, right? But you are, like, especially after an 8-year layoff. Kane loses his mask midway through the match, which, I mean, you know, it's not a big deal, but it's just an indication of how sloppy this shit is. It's just a slow slog of a match that, like, why are you doing this? Why are you doing this for your legacy? It's just not necessary, right? That's my worst match of the year. I mean, look, if you wanted to do a bottom five, you could throw in Alexa Bliss versus Nia Jax, Extreme Rules from Extreme Rules. But that was only 8 minutes long, so how mad can I be? John Cena and Bobby Lashley versus Owens and Elias from Super Showdown. And I got Brock and Strowman from, again, Crown Jewel. Crown Jewel is not a good show. Yeah, so that's the worst. Let's deal with the best, shall we? The top five matches. But before I do, let's hear from Steven Van Kooten. So remember, guys, if you want to participate in the show, you want to send me your thoughts, your questions, your memories, anything at all, I'm happy to read them out, and I'm happy to answer anything you ask. Actually, it's actually one of my most favorite parts of the show. That's not me as Krusty the Clown, like, talk to the audience. It's not what that is. It's because, like, the rest of the show is pretty well, I write most of it. So this is cool. It gives me a chance to kind of just think on my feet. So Steven writes in, and Steven says, I don't have much to add since I watched next to none of it. But even reading the results from this year was exhausting. There was simply too much content, and the length of every show was out of control. The Saudi shows also started this year, which is another bad look. Well, honestly, for anyone who followed the company for any length of time, they probably weren't shocked by it. Yeah, that's true. Of what I did see, the match quality is overall tremendous, but the volume of shows and the absurd length of each one meant everything was beat into the ground even more than usual. AJ Styles had a fantastic reign from a match quality perspective, but his feuds were uniformly awful from a storyline standpoint. I agree with that. It was a sad relief when Bryan took the title, who really shined in his awesome Earth's Champion role. The match with Lesnar is great and a testament to both guys for making the match matter when, really, there were no stakes. And speaking of, that brand supremacy stuff would have put the final nail in the coffin for Survivor Series if it hadn't already been beaten to death, exhumed, and had its corpse violated multiple times in the past 20 years. Hey, at least they didn't do a screw job at this one, Steven. All right, so let's count the little blessings we do have. It's amazing to watch this company botch Nakamura's main roster run from day one. Yeah. And this year might be the most egregious. I am probably in the minority, but I really like Lesnar and Mainz at WrestleMania, and their other two meetings were terrible. Easily my favorite wrestler of the year was Shayna Baszler. Nice. Who was booked great and had a unique punishing style that you don't see anymore. I agree. I don't have her in my top wrestlers of the year. She didn't quite make it, but I really like, I'm with you. I really like Baszler. There's something really interesting about her character. I love her punishing style. She's mean. Even her arrogance. I remember when she was first challenging for the title. I don't remember if it was this year or at the end of 2017 when she walked in on Ember Moon practicing submissions at one of the gyms, and she's just like mocking her, like, what is this? Look, it's garbage. Like, I think she's a really cool character, and I find her main roster run, look, I'm happy she's getting the tag title run or whatever she's doing now, but she just feels like an untapped potential person. There's a show dropping, I'm not exactly sure when, myself and my buddy Ryan Gray, we're breaking down the top 50 women list that WWE put out, and we talk about Shayna Baszler. And one of the things I mentioned is that I think her and, what's her name, Sonya Deville, are the ones that are really hurt by Ronda Rousey coming in, because it's just kind of a better version of both of their characters. And I mean, you can make an argument Shayna's just as good, but Ronda just has that star power. So I think they both kind of got hurt by Ronda Rousey coming in. I would push back a little bit on the Survivor Series. Like, I don't like, here's the problem, right? I don't like the brand supremacy stuff. I think it's dumb in terms of creating stakes. Like, who cares, right? No, none of them care. And we're supposed to care, right? So and there's no stakes at all. Maybe like they should add a stake to that. Like, whoever wins, make it like the baseball all-star game. So it's like whoever wins the total cumulative at Survivor Series gets, I don't know, the last five slots at the Royal Rumble or the main event of WrestleMania. Just something, give it something that matters, right? But the thing I will say about the Survivor Series and why for me, I think from 2016 on, it's a little bit of a highlight of the year, is because it forces them out of their rematch pattern that you mentioned. Because the rematches are insane, but because they're doing the brand supremacy stuff, because they're doing that, we dip out a bit with the Survivor Series, right? So it's like this year's Survivor Series, when you look at everything that's going on around it, like almost all the matches are more interesting than what's happening. Look, you got Ronda and Charlotte, which wouldn't happen normally. You've got Seth and Nakamura, which I think is actually a pretty great match. You got Brock and Bryan. So these are all great matches that happen because of the nature of the event, as opposed to just, you know, we're going along with the storylines. 2019 is like that too. But I agree. For the most part, the concept is dead. I would rather more Survivor Series matches, but, you know, it is what it is. Thanks, Steven. All right. So for the best matches, I have a lot of honorable mentions because there's a ton of four-star matches. So my honorable mentions start at four stars. AJ Styles versus Kevin Owens versus Sami Zayn versus Dolph Ziggler versus Baron Corbin versus John Cena from Fastlane, the six-pack challenge for the WWE title. I have Aleister Black versus Lars Sullivan at TakeOver Chicago for the NXT title. The War Games from TakeOver War Games. Rollins versus Shinsuke Nakamura from Survivor Series. We just mentioned it. The Women's Royal Rumble. Miz versus Rollins versus Balor. WrestleMania Triple Threat. That match doesn't get talked about enough as a good opener. The Undisputed Era versus the Authors of Pain. TakeOver Philadelphia. Styles versus Nakamura from Backlash. Styles versus Nakamura from Money in the Bank. See, they're all good. They're all great. But again, I could not tell them apart. Styles versus Joe from Hell in the Cell. Lesnar versus Bryan from Survivor Series. The mixed tag team match from WrestleMania in which Ronda Rousey makes her debut. Charlotte versus Asuka at WrestleMania. Ronda Rousey versus Charlotte from Survivor Series. Aleister Black versus Adam Cole from TakeOver Philadelphia. That's the four stars. We're not even in the top five. I'm at 4.25 next. Charlotte Flair versus Becky Lynch from Hell in a Cell. Velveteen Dream versus Ricochet TakeOver Chicago. And at 4.5 stars. Still not in the top five. Johnny Gargano versus Tommaso Ciampa, Street Fight, TakeOver Chicago. Andrade, Cien Almas versus Aleister Black, TakeOver New Orleans. Dolph Ziggler and Drew McIntyre versus Seth Rollins and Dean Ambrose from Hell in a Cell, that great tag team match. Becky Lynch versus Charlotte, last woman standing from Evolution. Tommaso Ciampa versus Velveteen Dream from War Games. Aleister Black versus Johnny Gargano from TakeOver War Games. Adam Cole, baby, versus Ricochet from TakeOver Brooklyn. Tommaso Ciampa versus Johnny Gargano, last man standing from TakeOver Brooklyn. At 4.75, this is the sixth best match now. Kyle O'Reilly and Roderick Strong versus Oney Lorcan and Danny Burch, TakeOver Chicago. All right, let's deal with the five best. Number five, O'Reilly and Strong versus Mustache Mountain from TakeOver Brooklyn. You look, just an incredible tag team match. They had a match it must have been just a couple weeks before on the NXT show, which is just as good. This is where O'Reilly and Strong regained the titles. I can't say enough good things about it. Number four, the Men's Royal Rumble, which we'll talk about later. It's at 4.75. And then we're into the five-star matches. I have three of them for the year, which is really high. Johnny Gargano versus Tommaso Ciampa, unsanctioned from TakeOver New Orleans. We'll talk about it later. And then the second best, Adam Cole versus Ricochet versus Killian Dane versus Lars Sullivan versus EC3 versus Velveteen Dream. Ladder match for the inaugural North American title at TakeOver New Orleans. I'll talk about it later. And the number one match of the year, Andrade Cien Almas versus Johnny Gargano, TakeOver Philadelphia. And that's the Gargano. I think I have that as like my 18th best match ever in the company history. Just a great underdog performance from Gargano. An incredible performance from Andrade. He gets no credit where Gargano gets all of it. Andrade is incredible in this match as the tougher bully heel. So, you know, go out of your way to see any of them. They're all very good. I mean, the problem I have is that even when they're good, I have to work myself up to watch them because they're long, right? And there's an emotional investment, right? Let's go with Victor Parenza here. He says, when I think of 2018, I think of two things. First, the main roster was trash, culminating with the "we're sorry, we'll listen to the fans now" speech from the McMahon family that went nowhere. Yeah, how's that going, McMahon family? Actually, you know what? They're not doing horrible now at listening. Like, look, I've seen a couple of memes where it's like, you know, the fans are never happy because, you know, they do listen and this and this. But I think right now, most fans are pretty like, look, you're always going to get outliers, right? But I'm pretty jaded. I'm pretty happy with who they're pushing for the most part. I think there are problems, right? But the people they have on top all make sense. I'm good. Lashley, I'm good with Drew McIntyre. I'm good with Sasha Banks and Bianca Belair and Asuka, you know, whatever. She is what she is. I'm good with Roman Reigns as a heel, right? So they are listening. There's a lot of work to be done there, and they don't listen on a lot of things, but it is progress. But I do remember that speech fondly. All right, back to Victor. Second, and most importantly, I think of NXT, which for me personally was at its apex. Gargano versus Ciampa was a compelling blood feud that had arguably one of the greatest matches in history at TakeOver New Orleans. The New Orleans show overall is easily on the short list of greatest shows ever. I agree. Also on the show was a debuting Ricochet in what was the best ladder match on WWE TV in over a decade, possibly ever. Yeah, I struggle with that match. We'll talk about it, but I struggle where to put that match, right? Also on that show was the debuting Ricochet's NXT run up until his abrupt call-up with Aleister Black, more on him in a minute, in early 2019 was nothing short of incredible. Yeah. If you look at all of this, his TakeOver matches and many TV matches, he absolutely stole the show nearly every single time. As for Aleister Black, he was the NXT champion throughout most of 2018. Unfortunately for him, his matches took a backseat for the Gargano-Ciampa feud. Still, his unique presence and style was a major contributing factor to the awesomeness of NXT in 2018. All this ranting, and I haven't even mentioned the Undisputed Era, whether singles, tag, or whatever, these guys were always bringing it. Adam Cole won his first North American title in the aforementioned ladder match and set himself up to be the bona fide main eventer that he is today throughout his stellar 2018 run. Seriously, how spoiled were we during 2018 NXT? I also want to shout out War Games from that year, which is just as good, if not better, than New Orleans. I know I'm in the minority here, but I think 18's War Games is far superior to 17's. And Ricochet's double moonsault off the cage is burned into my mind forever. On the undercard was an incredible title match between Ciampa and Velveteen Dream, who arguably became the most overkind NXT by the year's end. Also, there was a great Gargano versus Aleister match. Also in 2018 was Gargano versus Andrade from January, which many have said is the best NXT match ever. I haven't mentioned Pete Dunne, who went from NXT UK action to involved in main event angles, like War Games. I know the pundits say that NXT was truly at its best in 13-14. Who says that? But I say give me 2018 anytime. I look back on this time so fondly, and it's truly hard for me to say anything bad and it's truly hard for me to say that about anything in wrestling, being the jaded fan I am today. Yeah, I like, okay, so I think I'd have 2016 NXT higher than this one, from only because I'm not as high on Gargano. And I find that I never want to go back and watch his matches. Whereas 2016, I can watch anyway, and I like the women's division more in 2016. But I'll agree with you, the Undisputed Era is incredible. I want to make sure I talk about Aleister Black and Ricochet before the end of this episode, because I think there's something interesting about them. All right, guys, something else that's interesting that's going on is Tuesdays on the North-South Connection podcast network, right? So on every other Tuesday, you get TNA Never Dies, which is JT, Jenny Smith, and I going through NWA TNA from the very beginning. It's a struggle to watch, but it's a fun show to listen to, hopefully. So give that a try. And that runs alternatively with Jacob Williams, the Ruthlessly Aggressive podcast. Tomorrow, I believe he's dropping SummerSlam 2002 with our friend from the Place to Be Nation, Scott Criscolo. So give that a listen. If you're at all into that era, which is not an era that's dealt with super often on podcasts, Jake does a great job hosting. It's a lot of fun to listen to. Scott's always a fun guest, and they're talking about one of the greatest shows of all time, SummerSlam 2002. So give it a listen. All right, our next category, characters. Characters, I have it 23rd out of 36. It's not a strong character year, right? But let's go through a couple of them and see where it ranks up. So I got AJ Styles as a fighting champion, which I think is an interesting proposition. I guess they also tried to make him AJ Styles family man, and also AJ Styles man who's too stupid to wear a cup despite being punched in the nuts every night. Like, why don't he and Brock Lesnar invest in a goddamn jockstrap? Because, like, all they do is get punched in the nuts. Like, look, I get punched in the nuts. I got hit in the nuts once in baseball, at a cup the next day. I'd hit in the same thing in soccer and goalie. I get hit in the nuts, next time a cup. This guy's getting punched in the nuts every night, and he can't wear a jockstrap? When you're outsmarted by Road Dogg, you need to reevaluate some things about your life. And look, I think they struggle. They struggle with his character this year. He's one-dimensional, right? And so as a consequence, all the challengers are one-dimensional as well, which was mentioned earlier. Greg Diner chimes in and goes, oh no, not AJ's balls. That's the takeaway from the year, guys. Samoa Joe. Look, I love cool Samoan badass who went toe-to-toe with Lesnar. Love that from 2017. I don't understand when he becomes husky Samoan Rick Rude. Like, is he here to bang your wife? Is he going to raise your children? Is he going to give them a better life than you? Shinsuke Nakamura started the year as the king of strong style, and within 3 months, he did more ball handling than Larry Bird. And yes, that's a Planes, Trains, and Automobiles reference. And no, I don't think for one single second that Shinsuke thought those were pillows. But seriously, this became his whole character. He's punching Jeff Hardy in the nuts by year end. Why is he just the guy who punts guys in the nuts? Imagine how much he fucking hurt his hand punching Jeff Hardy in the nuts with all those piercings down there. Also, I love that guys can go from... This is another trope that I fucking hate in specific... Maybe it's on all wrestling. I don't notice it as much, but I notice it in WWE because that's what I watch the most. But like, how do you go from being an absolute killer in January to a guy that can barely survive matches in May? Why is it as soon as a character turns heel, they lose all their strength? You can see it now with Reigns. Like, look, Reigns... How many F5s did Reigns take in 2018, Roman Reigns? 75? 100? Right? And now Kevin Owens has him beat in 2 minutes? It's ridiculous. Lars Sullivan is a monster with a weird body. I'm fine. Look, I'm fine with the hair, right? I'm also fine with like the pasty, chippy chop body. I'm even fine with his triangular face. But look, you put them all together and no, okay? It's like I have this giant sense of unease that I can't put my finger on. And all I know is my kids are not allowed to meet this man. Rusev gets super over with Rusev Day. I mean, I know this sounds like an absurd concept, which I guess is why I liked it. I don't need an explanation as to what and why Rusev Day is or why it happens. I just want to see people get rewarded for getting over on their own and not destroyed. Harper and Rowan carry hammers now. That's it. That's their character. Also, they dress like assholes or hobos. Nia Jax is a bully victim. The bully. The bully who bullies her? A 5-foot-tall, 110-pound woman. Now, look, I'm not against the idea of a smaller person being a bully, but it's more the fact that Jax had been bullying people for 3 years. And now we're going to rally behind her because this blonde little girl is making fun of her? You've been an asshole as long as you've been on TV as a character. Maybe you're a fine person. I don't know. And I've been thinking about this because, you know, we're recently, when this is the time of recording, we have the whole Shane McMahon bullying Braun Strowman. I'm thinking, why do they keep casting the largest person in the division as the bully victim? And what I came to was, it's because they feel everybody bullies them. They, as a company, they think everybody's bullying them all the time. The media is not nice to them. WCW is bullying us. AEW is bullying us. Meanwhile, you're a giant monopoly worth billions of dollars. It's almost like, I know the word bully gets thrown around a lot, you know, and maybe sometimes too much, but like, it's almost like they take criticism because they're the giant and criticism as being bullied, right? And so because they're a big company and they get bullied, well, it makes sense to make a character like Nia Jax, who's the largest in the division and gets bullied. Kurt Angle this year, we found out he has a son. We also find out it's not Chad Gable. It's Jason Jordan. And is that still canon? Is he still his son in the... I can't keep track of who's whose son. So Jordan is Kurt Angle's son. Hornswoggle is Finley's son, right? Dominic Mysterio is Eddie Guerrero's son? The only parentage we're sure of is Shane, because he looks just like his fucking dad. All right. I actually struggled to think about what Bray Wyatt was doing in 2018. And I was like, well, he didn't ruin anything. Like, was he hurt? Was he not around? And... because if he's around, something's going to get ruined. Then I remember he's with Matt Hardy, and I guess that was fine. Maybe he ruined Matt Hardy? I don't know. Big Cass is a bad guy for some reason. I guess instead of continuing your successful team, it's better to go out on your own, adopt an elbow drop as a finisher, and then be in tons of camera shots that make it look like your name is Big Ass. The B team are losers. I guess I like Bo Dallas. I don't know why he's not in the Wyatt family. Curtis acts like, I guess I could take or leave, but he's a good hand, if you will. But their characters are literally the three losers. John Cena has learned some sort of a karate punch. I bring this up because it's the most character development this guy's had since 2004. The Riot Squad have tattoos. Kevin Owens is a jobber. Jinder Mahal, who spent the whole year before as world champion, is just a jobber. Except in the Rumble. I like him in the Rumble, actually. I also really like Carmella as a character. The whole Mella is money gimmick was a lot of fun. She's like just the right level of obnoxious and a great addition to a women's division that at times kind of struggles to have compelling, diverse characters. And I don't mean diverse in terms of just appearance. I'm just like what each character is and what they are. And when your whole division are like these killers, which is kind of what the SmackDown side was at this, like SmackDown at this point was like on top was Charlotte, Becky, and Asuka, right? Those are killers, right? So it's good. It works at this point to have a weakling champion. If everybody's weakling, it doesn't make sense. But like this, it's fine. Anyway, I like her work in 2018. Speaking of killers, man, Ronda Rousey was a killer. What a perfect example of someone not needing to talk to get completely over. This woman comes in and she overhauls the entire way we think about women's wrestling. And without her, without Ronda Rousey, as good as the other women are, and I think the other women are better than her, right? But without her, we're probably never given the Evolution pay-per-view. We're never given the WrestleMania main events. Her whole character was great, just down to the way she walked. Like, there was no phoniness in her, just legit badass. Tough as nails, like, through and through. I love Ronda Rousey this year. And then she was getting it on the mic as it went on. Man, if she had like 3-4 years in the company, I mean, I'd be concerned about them worrying her. About them ruining her and making her less interesting. But I feel if she was like honed, as honed as she is at Ultimate Fighting and Judo, if she was as honed like as that in wrestling, holy shit, she'd be the best ever. Dave Hall chimes in. The standout moment for me in 2018 was the arrival of Ronda Rousey in the company. She appeared at the end of the first ever Women's Royal Rumble. It was exciting, but her debut at WrestleMania partnering with Kurt Angle against Triple H and Stephanie was truly amazing. To me, this match stole the show, and Rousey was amazing in her first ever match. Credit to Hunter and Stephanie for putting her over in a big way. Yep, credit where credit's due there. Her ability to pick up this great sport so quickly was only ever seen in one other person. Her teammate that night, Kurt Angle. 2018 was the year of Rowdy Ronda Rousey. It's hard to disagree. The other highlight was the WWE's decision to put on a major event down here in Australia. The first ever Super Showdown allowed me to attend a live pay-per-view caliber event in my home country, capped by a hometown wins for Buddy Murphy and the Iconics. I can't believe that's awesome, Dave. I think that's really cool. Like, as some like, look, I've had the privilege of come. They've done pay-per-views in Montreal. They've done three, and I've gotten to go to. I've been to two of them. I didn't go to the other one on purpose. But like, it is special to kind of go see pay-per-view in your hometown. And I've had three pay-per-views before and I'm still like, ugh, they never come here, right? So I can't imagine what it's like if they've never been there. But I'm shocked that they gave wins to Buddy Murphy and Iconics. You think their normal MO is to crush someone in their hometown. All right, back to the characters. Alexa Bliss is the Queen Bee without ever having to call herself a Queen Bee. Like in TNA, I think she's solid on the mic. She parlayed the character well into the matches too. She's got some great little character stuff she does in the match that I think works really well. Johnny Gargano is unbeatable. You'd probably have to hit him in the back with a hydrogen bomb to get a 2¾ count on him. Asuka started the year as unstoppable, then got stopped. I wish someone would eventually book someone well post-winning streak. So that we'd have a reliable example to go back to. Not that they follow their own examples, but I don't think we've ever been able to do that. Like, you don't. I've yet to see a great storyline in the wake of a long winning streak. And it's not. This is not just a WWE thing. This is everywhere. Daniel Bryan as the Planet's champion was wonderful. I love him calling the fans fickle. This was the exact kick in the ass the character needed. And honestly, the decision to pivot on. Their decision to pivot on him really highlights the folly in not turning Cena and Reigns earlier in their careers, even if it was in the short term. Bryan returns at Mania here, and it feels special, but his character is way behind what it was in 2015. And it's fine. It's normal. He hasn't been around, right? But then this run happens, and he completely revitalizes himself. Now, 2 years later, he's back in the main event of WrestleMania, right? And he feels special again. Sometimes you just need that little heel run to remind everyone of how great you can be because they don't know how to book faces. And like, we'll never know, but I'd be curious what the wrestling landscape looks if they turn either of their big dogs in the short term, Cena and Reigns. I mean, look at Reigns now going forward. This guy's going to be cheered forever after this run. Also, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention Bryan's eco belt, which is a great addition to the character. The stones, the hemp. What a home run as a character. NXT is generally not the greatest realm of characters, but there's a couple I like to point out. And I know it's a bit uncouth to like him now, and I get why. But Velveteen Dream, man, was a revelation at the time. The flamboyance was great. The cosplay was great. But I think his character work in the matches is what sets him apart. His matches were always either about gaining respect or winning titles. So there was always a... There's always an objective in there behind it, right? And it started the year before when he fought Aleister Black, but then it continued this year through all of his matches. See, it's funny. These are the matches I remember, right? More so than the big main events. And I love that he didn't win or lose matches. He survived matches. Like, and all of his wins, he just ekes out. And he always comes out of every interaction stronger. I really appreciated Velveteen Dream in 2018. Another guy I really loved in 2018, character-wise, is Tommaso Ciampa. So he doesn't wrestle enough matches to qualify for Wrestler of the Year, because you need to be in a quarter of the matches, right? And he only wrestles four times. But his character that's obsessed with being champion, this should be a lesson that every professional wrestler in the promotion should be forced to watch. Everyone should want to win the title. That's the goal. Ciampa took this and based his whole character on it. And the problem is it's a unique character in current WWE, right? And I'm sure I've ranted at length about wrestlers as characters on a show without objectives, but Ciampa is a great example of what to do. And look, I will say, finally, even with Ronda Rousey breaking in and taking over the women's division throughout the year, this was also Becky Lynch's year. The turn on Charlotte was great, right? It's just one Charlotte too many, and she snapped and broke on her, right? Then she becomes this huge ass kicker. I won't call her a last kicker. It's fucking stupid. But she's this huge ass kicker, and it's a great sight to see. It's the first time I can ever remember a woman being the number one attraction for the company. And it's probably the last one that they would have expected. Looking at, like, when they look at their top four or five women, they're not picking Becky Lynch. You just know it, right? The image of her busted open on Raw is just such an all-time incredible scene. And I don't want to see her get hurt, but it allowed that little speck of realism that entered a product that sometimes you need, right? And then she rolled with it in the best way. She cemented her legacy, and she deserved everything she got on her work here. You know who else deserves everything they get? Justin Pratt and Tim Slomka, talking about New Gen on a mission. They're going down the new, on the North South Connection Podcast Network, they are going down the new generation era. Their last show, last Wednesday, and it drops every second Wednesday, was Royal Rumble 93, and I really enjoyed it. I think these guys do a great job of breaking down the minutia. They've got some really great chemistry, too. I love, too, that they're like, they talked at length about Lex Luger and his debut, and it was a lot of fun. So give that show a listen, New Gen on a Mission, every other Wednesday on the North-South Connection Podcast Network. Our next category, WrestleMania. I had it, I think JT and I ranked this on No Holds Barred. Let's do this while we're at it. Saturdays, No Holds Barred, two times a month. Last year, we ranked every single pay-per-view per month. So the best pay-per-view ever in January, the best pay-per-view ever in February, and we did WrestleMania's for March, right? And this is where we get the ranking here. This year, we are doing the best wrestler in January, best wrestler in February, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that drops two Saturdays a month. There's the list, and then we do a live watch as well on the other day. Also, you get JT's mailbag on Saturdays, which is a lot of fun. It gives him a chance to kind of like freestyle and answer questions, and it's a nice, relaxed show and a cool atmosphere. And JT's awesome, so give that a listen too. And finally, from Squared Circle to Silver Screen, that's Logan and the Cowboy, watching movies either about wrestling or starring wrestlers. Again, all going on Saturday on the North South Connection Podcast Network. WrestleMania, we had it 21st out of 36. And I still don't know what to think about this WrestleMania. But I know I have little desire to watch it again, despite almost everything on it being good. And that's so weirdly true to this whole era, right? This Mania was the whole John Cena has no path. I have no pathway to WrestleMania, which felt utterly and fucking completely ridiculous. Am I to believe that if John Cena walked up to the brass and asked for a match at WrestleMania, they'll say no, right? If I'm going to believe that, I might as well believe that this product is based on legitimate athletic competition. The opener was very strong. I really liked the triple threat match with Finn Balor, Miz, and Seth Rollins. Finn Balor follows a parade down to the ring. And it's like, they had no idea what to do with Finn, which is sad. And look, Making him an LGBTQ avatar is a good idea in theory. But it feels really hollow when you look at how the company treated Darren Young. They really made Darren Young a token. He was the token gay man. And for like, I don't know, 3-month period, they made it a big deal. And then they discarded him, right? And Darren Young was good. And he could have gotten better, right? Instead of doing something with Darren Young, they give this character to Finn Balor, right? And I don't know what Finn Balor's orientations are or whatever, but you know, he's certainly not presented as a member of the LGBTQ community on TV. If he's not backstage, I'm kind of surprised they don't catch more heat for this, right? Because WWE is kind of immune to this stuff, right? So you get like Vince saying the N-word, you get blackface, you get a guy playing a guy with Down syndrome. Like, they're probably pretty lucky that mainstream media, and by that I mean mainstream activism, doesn't pay attention to them. Anyway, look, the match is good. Like, a legit great opener. Maybe the third or fourth best opener in WrestleMania, which kind of seems crazy. Then Charlotte and Asuka have what I feel is the best match on the show. I also like the Charlotte win, because I thought it was surprising. And it made it interesting that they kind of flipped the script a little here. And the problem is that you can do this if you're going to follow up with Asuka well. Unfortunately, they're not great at following things up. Jinder Mahal won a 4-way match. In this match, he was the least over. However, he was the one that the company wanted to push, so he got the win. Also, did you know that Bobby Roode is glorious? And that's entirely 100% all of what he is. Next, Ronda Rousey has one of the best debut matches in company history as she teams with Kurt Angle to fend off Triple H and Stephanie. I thought this match was really smartly worked, in that they kept Steph away from her until just the right time. And I love Rousey's explosive energy. Like, she's just such a natural. And her moves, everything just looked different, but looked great. I was very happy to see it. So far, I mean, this show seems really, really great. What's my fucking problem, right? Then the Bludgeon Brothers squash the tag team division. Again, I'm fine with this. This is fine. Undertaker squashes John Cena. And I'm actually fine with this too, right? This was fine too. Like, whatever, like, it was like 3 minutes of him just kicking the crap out of him. But whatever. I would have preferred one of the multiple other times they could have done this match to have done it and had a complete match. But whatever, you know. Then Daniel Bryan returns to team with fucking Shane McMahon versus Sami and Owens. Now, the match isn't bad or anything, but it's really underwhelming when you get past the return. Nia Jax has a WrestleMania moment beating Alexa Bliss and winning the title. I don't like that match, but whatever. It's not the worst. And James Grunberg chimed in. I found the Shinsuke Nakamura AJ match to be very boring. I'm going to guess that he means the WrestleMania one. But James, if I'm wrong, tell me. Because there's like 8 of them this year. So AJ and Nakamura fight. Now look, I really think the ending's incredible. When AJ kind of like transitions the Kinshasa into the Styles Clash. But I don't get why they waited until the final minute of the match to get into that big match gear. To me, I have this match, I think, of 4 stars. But it's a huge disappointment. Especially when you consider how they marketed the match as it being just the dream match of dream matches. And anytime they've ever done that, it never turns out well. Just think back to Michaels and Perfect in 93. It's the exact same idea. And this is a match they were teaming since the Money in the Bank the year before. You got to make title matches about the title instead of the performance. Because this completely underdelivered and in many ways ended up hurting the show. People think back at this, oh, the AJ Nakamura match. It's actually still a very good to great match, right? Imagine this kind of match hurting the show. But when you ask someone, they almost universally tell you it was bad. And it wasn't, but that's the level of disappointment. And it's not like these two can't have a great match. If you're a hater of NJPW, I challenge you to watch their Wrestle Kingdom 10 match. And tell me how anything they did together in WWE even comes close to that performance. Look, anyone who listens to this show should know how much I love The Bar. Cesaro is great. Sheamus is like, I love Sheamus. Fucking love Sheamus, goddammit. Even if you don't like them, you'd be hard-pressed to say that these two weren't presented as tough bastards, right? Which is why one guy teaming with a child defeating them for the tag team titles is stupid. Plus, it wasted so much time. They couldn't put that kid in the front row. We know it's going to be a plant, all right? We know. We don't need the 5-minute pantomime where you're like trying to legitimize this whole fucking ball of shit. And why do this to The Bar? Look, I get it. If you're fighting the bodied on us, maybe the kid could be your partner. But The Bar? It's a colossal waste of time and just dumb. Now, we close the show with the inevitable. I say it's just inevitable. Brock Lesnar versus Roman Reigns match. And then Brock wins. And I was happy he won, I guess. But I felt like they phoned it in. Like, none of the 2015 magic here. And I know some people might like it. But for me, it felt like a downer to end the night. So the last three matches really hurt the show. See, if you end with Cena and Undertaker, this one feels like an all-timer. But you don't. You get all of their guys. You're getting Braun and you're getting Roman as the top faces in 2018, whether you want them. Whether you want them or not. World title storyline. 31st out of 36. And here we see the problem with who they have on top. So let's deal with the obvious one first. So imagine this category finishing 31 out of 36 years. And yet we only have two WWE champions all year. AJ Styles and Daniel Bryan. How are we here? Well, AJ Styles fights 10 one-on-one matches on pay-per-view this year versus four opponents. He fights Bryan and Rusev once. Rusev was just a total... Bryan was just because of the Survivor Series. No, excuse me, just because he wanted the rematch. And Rusev was just a throwaway. He fights Shinsuke Nakamura four times and Samoa Joe four times. But none of the rematches are useful in any way. Why does Nakamura... Look, I love Nakamura. Why does he get a rematch? Because he punched him in the penis after the match? He lost clean. But then he gets another shot. And then another shot. And then another shot. Right? And of course, in both of these series, we have to have a match where the result is some kind of a draw. Otherwise, there's no reason to go back to the well four fucking times. And I get why AJ's reign is considered a disappointment. Because he's just trapped in this stasis of fighting the same guys for no reason. Then on the other show, the champion just isn't there. And when the title is being defended, you got Brock Lesnar and Braun Strowman in every match. Now, and look, I'm not an advocate of the champion needing to be there at every pay-per-view, right? But if it is going to be sporadic, can we just get some variety in the matches? Why is Kane challenging for a championship match in 2018, but other people have to win Royal Rumbles to get a shot? I think the match between Brock and Reigns at SummerSlam, where Reigns wins the title, is the perfect microcosm of the whole title scene. Brock is defending against Reigns again, and so the crowd won't shit on the match. They send the Money in the Bank winner, Braun, out there to give the fans some hope. Like, imagine, we know they're going to shit on the match. Let's trick them into thinking something else will happen. How about you just give them a match that they want to see? Reigns wins. Braun cashes in his shot at Hell in a Cell, loses then. And then Reigns gets sick, which sucked, right, for him. But then they just have a match between Brock and Braun in Saudi Arabia to crown a new champion. How fucking lazy is that, right? One guy's never there. The other guy's the top face everybody hates. The third is a monster who's been presented like a fucking loser. And he gets destroyed by Brock in Saudi Arabia. Why not crown Braun there? Anyway, what a bad year for the world title. Should have been last place, maybe. All right. What's definitely not last place is Thursdays on the North-South Connection Podcast Network. Usually you get either JT and Chad, Wrestling Warzone. They're on a bit of a hiatus, but they're coming back. Their last episode from last week is a flashback of WCW Halloween Havoc 1995. But they are breaking down the Monday Night War era, doing show to show. Great analysis, fun stuff. My personal favorite they've done so far has been WrestleMania 12, but there's tons. There's a lot of good stuff there. And that runs in tandem with ECW Three-Way Dance, Extreme Three-Way Dance, JT, John D'Amato, and Jennifer Smith, going down the rabbit hole of ECW from, I guess, the very beginning of their big shows. So it's a lot of fun. There's lots of Italian humor, if you like that too. But check it out every Thursday on the North-South Connection Podcast Network. Mid-card storyline, 30th out of 36. I find it difficult to remember a single mid-card feud from 2018. It's also very tough to even remember who the secondary champions are. On the Intercontinental side, Rollins does quite well in multi-man matches, but and even has a defense against Elias. But then it's lazily back to the Intercontinental stalwarts of Miz and Dolph Ziggler. I swear, when JT and I listed the best shows of each month, it was alarming how often we talked about the Miz or Dolph Ziggler being involved in the Intercontinental title scene for a decade. Stale and tired, stop it. But then it gets dumb. Then Dean Ambrose is suddenly a germaphobe and he's wearing a gas mask for some reason. Yeah, right? You know, what are we doing here, right? The US title is even worse, but at least it involves some newer guys. Rude loses it to Orton, who loses it to Jinder, whatever. Then Jinder and Hardy have a botch fest in Saudi Arabia before Hardy ends up feuding with Shinsuke Nakamura. And I like Shinsuke Nakamura as U.S. champion in WWE. But when you take a guy like Shinsuke, who's he's been repeatedly beaten in the main event, right? And then right away you crown him as your secondary champion, you make the whole division look lesser as a consequence. Because it stops being about a title for guys on the way up, right? Because that's always what when it was at its best, it's for guys on their way up. When you think of the greatest intercontinental champions of all time, you don't think of The Miz, right? Who won it only after he won the world title, despite the fact he's done it a billion times, right? You think about Randy Savage, who's on his way up. You think about Bret Hart, who's on his way up. Shawn Michaels, on his way up. Randy Orton, on his way up, right? When you put it on the guy who's lost a bunch in the main event and then he suddenly wins the secondary title, well, now it's a title for guys on the way down. And that's a big distinction, right? Who cares about a belt for guys on the way down? It's not interesting anymore. And then when they get beat, they have nowhere to go but even lower, right? So then you add in the countless rematches and the small circle of guys who gets title shots, and you got a boring year for these belts. Look, there's 15 main roster WWE shows. There's no reason not to have 15 distinct challengers for these mid-card titles. Maybe a couple of rematches, you know? You make the rematch the special thing because something happened in the match to warrant the rematch, right? Instead, you just have no idea what to do with most of your guys. So you notice, I really, you know, unless I dig deep, there's only like 5 or 6 guys that I really have any material to talk about, right? Because they just don't care. All right, tag team title scene is next. I have it 16th out of 36, but let's hear from Ryan Gray. Ryan Gray, 2018 benefited from the peak of the women's division. From the first women's Royal Rumble all the way to the Evolution pay-per-view, the man emerges and Ronda elevated the importance of the whole division. Yeah, good stuff from the women in 2018. NXT carried a lot of the work rate. Strong NXT year up and down. Top three Rumble? Men's Rumble was great. Women's Rumble is also good with historical importance that should carry a lot of weight. Middling but good enough WrestleMania and a fun Survivor Series. Aaron, how did the tag team division line up? Okay, before I answer that, like I mentioned, Ryan's making his debut. It's dropping soon, I believe on Wednesday, on the North-South Connection Podcast Network. So give it a listen, okay? One of the things I want to start doing with this kind of platform, and I'll try to branch out a little more, is to really, like, if you're a listener of the show and you've never done a podcast before, and it's something you want to try, get in touch with me. Because I think, I don't know, like, that's what I would have wanted done. And that's kind of what happened with JT and Scott back with the Place to Be Nation stuff. So let me know, you know, and I'm serious. If it's something you want to try, and you never, even if you've done it before, it's something you want to try, let me know. Get in touch with me, okay? So Ryan continues to ask, how did the tag team division line up? That Rollins and Ambrose and McIntyre match is at Hell in a Cell was fantastic. Curious how the division panned on the list. Well, I have it 16 to 36, so a little above average. I do agree that match is really great, and I quite love it. So let's take a look at it. So I think the SmackDown tag team scene is super healthy. You got the Usos, the New Day, Harper and Rowan. They're all excellent. They're doing a fantastic job carrying the division. Now, I think the Raw tag team title scene is kind of the opposite, where Braun and Nicholas being the champions until the Leaders of Worlds take the title. Then I guess the Leaders of Worlds make more sense than the Eater of Worlds. But they have, like, lackluster defenses. They're fighting the B team. They just don't care about the Raw tag. So I will say, the SmackDown side, they care about the titles, but it's always the same teams fighting for it. So no one's really getting ahead or moving, right? It's all kind of a stasis. But I'll take it because it's great matches. The Raw tag team title, it's different champions, but they don't care. I mean, like, you're putting them against the B team, they don't care. However, I think NXT is the saving grace, right? A few years ago on the Place to Be Nation website, we did a list of the 100 greatest tag teams in WWE history. I want to say it dropped in 2019, January, but I might be wrong. It might have been 2018. Oh, no, it was 2018. Yeah, it was in 2018. Now, I think that there is a very good case to be made now for the Undisputed Era to be the number one team. And I think it starts in 2018. Whether it's O'Reilly and Fish or O'Reilly and Strong, these guys kill it every time. Their feud with Mustache Mountain is sublime. And they're Mustache Mountain was a perfect babyface team to go up against these killers. And the Undisputed Era can also be the underdogs as well when they go up against the AOP, right? And then you get the killer match against Lorcan and Birch. And see, look how varied this tag team division is. Every show, there's a new challenger, a different challenger. And as a consequence, everything feels fresh, despite having the same champions for most of the year. Man, it's a wonderful division. It might be my favorite in wrestling. So I think, Ryan, I think middle of the pack is fine because they don't care about the main roster tag team titles. I feel like that Hell in a Cell match is kind of a blip because they suddenly care about... It's because they care about Rollins and Ambrose more than they care about tag team wrestling, and they don't want to put them on top. But yeah, I think NXT tag team division carries this the strongest. Speaking of things that carry the network, take a look for on Fridays for Shrink Wrapped, the Psychology of Superheroes. Jenny Smith, Sean Kidd, and Tim Capel breaking down the psychology of all your favorite comic book heroes. And that runs in tandem sometimes with Jordan Duncan's Rank and File. I've been on that a couple times. We've ranked the Arrested Development characters. We ranked the Parks and Recs characters. It's a tournament bracket-based show, but it's a lot of fun. And look, on Sundays, you're dealing with Second Print Comics, which is Mark Clare and Remzo Martinez. Their latest episode was Ninjak versus the Valiant Universe. Man, I think it's Valiant. Look, I'm a big fan of the old Valiant comics, so this was a cool throwback. And I really appreciate Mark and Remzo and everything they do. It's really a pleasure to have them on the network. And finally, after every major show, viewer's choice, Marcus and Tim breaking it down for you. And that's a hell of a job because they're up late recording. They're up late editing. So give them a try. Marcus and Tim on the North-South Connection Podcast Network, viewer's choice. All right. Women's division, number one out of 30. So this is 2018's bread and butter, and it all starts with the debut of Ronda Rousey at the Royal Rumble. This debut, as well as the foundation created by the likes of Asuka and the Four Horsewomen women, are really why the women's division flourishes here. It was the exact, Rousey was the exact right amount of star power to inject into the division. And it's not like what else is happening isn't exciting as well. This is especially strong on the SmackDown side. Charlotte is the completely credible champion going into WrestleMania, and she has a killer defense against Asuka. Then Carmella cashes in, the first Money in the Bank winner, right? And while I don't really love her beating Asuka twice in the defenses, she was at least a strong enough character to keep it going. Then the Becky stuff starts in earnest at SummerSlam, and we're off to the races, man. Becky takes the title in the great Hell in a Cell match against Charlotte. They follow up with an incredible Last Woman Standing match at Evolution. And then Asuka takes the title finally on the last pay-per-view of the year. But, I mean, this was the title with the biggest women's stars, and really the biggest stars in the company, Charlotte, Becky, and Asuka by the end of the year. It was the most exciting division with the most exciting characters. They all felt like they had real motivation. Becky felt wronged. Her journey was very organic, right? And they caught fire at exactly the right time. So even her injury, Becky, helped her. If she fights Ronda Rousey at Survivor Series, maybe she just loses and they transition to Charlotte for Mania. So thank you, Nia Jax, for being a clumsy fuck and creating this nice little thing. Now, on the Raw side, I think it's a bit shakier with Alexa Bliss and Nia Jax feuding. But then as soon as the belt goes around Ronda, things take off, right? She's the most credible female performer they've ever had. And her athleticism makes her just a natural for the business. The matches with Bliss are fun. And I don't even mind her matches with Nia Jax or Nikki Bella. Rousey's match with Charlotte at Survivor Series is awesome, right? It's just a war. You don't get wars in the women division. This is a war. And watching her fight Bliss versus watching her fight Charlotte felt like it wasn't even in the same division. And I like the Bliss matches. And then on NXT, Shayna Baszler and Kairi Sane are just killing it all year. So women's wrestling was so great in 2018 that they gave them their own pay-per-view, which was a really great, balanced, and exciting show. We got the excellent Mae Young final with Toni Storm and Io Shirai. We get the NXT title win with Shayna Baszler in the aforementioned matchup with Rousey and Bella and Charlotte and Becky. And I think something that gets a bit overlooked in 2018 is how well the women handled nostalgia and their legends. So like Lita and Trish team up to fight Mickey and Alicia Fox at Evolution. It's a great opener. Pops the crowd really well. And also the first Women's Royal Rumble was great. What a brilliant move to make Sasha and Banks and Becky Lynch the cornerstones of the match. And again, back to the legends, they brought all the right people back and put them all in positions to look good. I feel like different people are booking the women than booking the men, because here everybody's getting played to their strengths. Michelle McCool looked great. Fuck, even Vicky Guerrero coming in and screaming was fun, right? The Women's Royal Rumble was just a great love letter to like past and present women's wrestling. And I think the right person went over, and even having the Bellas in the end was really smart because they were heels that everybody hated. Women's wrestling was the highlight of the show in 2018. And it's really one of the reasons why I feel like I'm harder on the older versions of women's wrestling, because it can be amazing. And in some cases, it can be better than the men's division, which it is here. I just want it to stay here. I don't want it to regress. Rocco Martone. I'm going to assume that 2018 is so highly ranked because most of it is based on the quality of NXT, Ronda Rousey, and the entire women's division, and an incredible roster of guys having great matches while toiling in generic feuds. Yeah, that's a good... Speaking of NXT, what do you feel is the point of NXT? It is certainly not to make main eventers. It functions as its own thing, especially with guys like Andrade, Black, and Ricochet, who were all main eventing this year's Mania, right? But as developmental, it only really produces WWE mid-carders. Man, Rocco, I have so much to say about that. Like, I'm going to do... I don't know when I'm going to do it. If anybody wants to do that podcast with me, let me know. Because I think it's an embarrassment of riches of talent that they've had come through the NXT system since 2015. And that there aren't more main eventers out of it is... I don't understand. I just don't understand. It's a massive failure. Like a massive, massive, massive failure. How you've lost Andrade is ridiculous. This guy could do everything, right? But he's not even the most egregious. You mentioned Aleister Black and Ricochet. Look, I guess there's still time with both these guys. But Ricochet is maybe legitimately the most athletically gifted guy they've ever, ever had. Watch him flip out of the ring and get in a Velveteen Dream's face. And it's not like he can't put good matches together too. It's not a question of he's great athletically but not good at putting matches together. Watch his Japan stuff. Watch his PWG stuff. Fuck. Watch his Lucha Underground stuff as Prince Puma. You got this guy and you have nothing to do with him except put him backstage hanging out in catering or hanging out for skits. It's crazy. This is the type of guy who you build an actual revolution around. Hey, stuff's getting a bit stale. Well, we're going to do this incredibly athletic style now. And here's our guy, Ricochet. I don't understand. And Aleister Black, man, what is happening? What a compelling, interesting character coming out of NXT. But we just have nothing for him. Great in the ring, interesting character, decent enough talker. It makes no sense. It makes no sense that these guys aren't doing anything. And if they lose Black and Ricochet like they've lost Andrade, well, you're going to have to look at this era as like if your sports team traded away all their best draft picks. And this is me saying this. I like the guys on top, right? But like one of the problems I have with the guys on top is that they don't have any credible challengers. Well, then why haven't you built these guys up to be those credible challengers? Because when they come up to the main roster, they're all massively over. Right? But now they're not. It's not their fault. Anyway, back to Rocco. What do I think the point of NXT is? Well, it should be to create main eventers. But it doesn't. Is it treated like ECW was in the late 90s, where WWF poaches the good dudes, strips them of all momentum, identity, usually their surname, and then makes them start at zero? With the bizarre trend of one-named wrestler, how many have actually become main eventers? I'm sorry, Rocco. None of them. None of them. Like, who's the top... Look, besides the women, who are the people that have come through NXT that have done well on the main roster? Look at Matt Riddle! Now. Okay. Balor versus Corbin at the SummerSlam. Thank you for adding the. Really stood out as the type of warrior honky squash that we've never seen anymore. I agree. Ronda and Kurt versus Triple H and Steph was a super fun match. Although, it might have only been booked as some sort of a strange reverse cuckold scenario, with Steph watching Trips get manhandled by a tough blonde chick. Roman versus Brock, again. Aaron, what's the story of this long rivalry? What point did it serve? How did it change the characters? Why any of this? Dude, I got no answers for you. Because it did no one any favors, right? Because if you... Just have him beat Brock. Just have him beat Brock clean and destroy him. Then at least he looks like the guy who killed Brock. But no, they made him lose a bunch of times instead. Why any of this? Because they're not creative. And they don't want to think for a minute and think of ways to get other challengers involved. They're like, okay, we're just going to keep doing Roman Brock till it goes to Roman. And then who knows what their plan was with Roman, right? But that's their plan. It probably was Seth Roman. That was probably their plan, right? But that's how they think. They don't want to be creative. All right, back to Rocco. Asuka and Daniel Bryan spent the year proving they're two of the best ever to be in the WWE. The match quality this year is a wild example of how much incredible talent they have on the roster. Unfortunately, the lack of stories anyone cares about pretty much amounts to, look how much talent it takes to make me forget everything I just watched syndrome. Oh, Rocco's the best. Evolution was great and one of the only pay-per-views of the recent years I have rewatched in whole a few times. An incredible show from front to back. It exemplifies why I generally get more engaged in the women in this current era. Fun characters and a colorful presentation that recalls the pre-Attitude era before every dude wore black and tried to look cool. Plus, not every match has flippy do dives and the Seth Rollins style of moves for moves' sake in which nothing hurts. I get what you say about the early Trish era stuff exposing the business, but I like when matches get a little sloppy. Yeah, I don't mind some sloppiness too. Don't get me wrong. I'm not talking about the Undertaker constantly trying to do the tombstone dick in the face reversal choreography type fuck up, but a little messy is fine with me. Aaron, do you think WWE should do a yearly all women's event? How about a weekly show? Or just devote an hour of Raw to the women? You know, at first when they did the brand split, I thought that they should just have the women on one brand and then, you know, have the tag division on the other brand, treat it as a different division. I'd be down for an all-women's show. I don't want to see them just get an hour because an hour, they won't put enough people on it. I think they have enough of a good women's roster now to just make it its own separate show and then have them have matches on pay-per-views. An all-women's event? Sure. I think it'll never be as good as that first one, so I worry about that. But if you had an all-women's show that built to all-women's pay-per-views, I'd be okay with that. Like, it was just this whole separate thing. Instead of it being a side attraction, it can be the attraction. Speaking of the women's divisions, it's wild to see how little Bayley and Sasha had this year. Yeah, right? They've been two of my favorites since their early NXT days, but they really took a backseat this year. I recently watched both of their Stone Cold Session interviews, and boy, did it have opposite effects for me. While Bayley made me a bigger fan and pretty much came off as a totally cool person, Sasha almost erased years of my fandom. I don't know if it was supposed to be a slightly in character, but man, it was beguiling how unpleasant she seemed. I'm not some insecure macho dude who doesn't like confident women, but she came off as completely tone deaf for me. Aaron, how do you feel a non-canonical media does or should play a part in the investment of a character, be it in wrestling or any art? What is your personal history meeting someone in your theater world and how it positively or negatively affected your interaction with their work? Oh man, there's lots of that. Okay, but first, yeah, I agree. That interview with Sasha was so strange. Just a strange thing. And like, I don't know if it was in character or not. Like, how many times can you say that you're the best? And like, it's not that I don't like confidence. You know, I remember someone saying like, well, you know, people don't say they're the best enough. Like, I heard that recently and it's like, okay, but you also don't have to say it every sentence. And then saying things like, I don't understand why people don't walk around saying they're the best all the time. Well, because there's such a thing as like being a human, you know? So I came off with a very bad taste in my mouth too from that interview with her. Like I, you know, but then I just saw the video of her after she lost the title to Bianca Belair, and she looked so genuinely happy for her. And then she also, the night Bayley debuted on the main roster, she looked so happy for her there too, you know? So I don't know what to think of Sasha Banks, but she's good. I try to just base artists on their art. It's hard. Like, I don't really want to revisit Benoit, right? In the theater world, forget it. There's a lot of people I just don't like, and it goes beyond just one meeting, right? But yeah, that's a challenge. So I'm with you. I remember I met this artist. So I did Shakespeare in the Park for this company here for many years when I was younger. And I was playing lead parts for them every summer, right? And they changed the person in charge, who's the artistic director. And I ran into him doing a radio station interview, and I introduced myself to him. And, you know, like, I asked him, what are you guys doing next year? And the level of big timing he did to me turned me off ever working for that company again. Because it's like, well, I've been your lead for, you know, for 4 years now. Like, you know, I'm not, you know, I'm not being a dick. I'm just actually legitimately curious. So yeah, you know, if it's in your own world, I think it affects who you work with. As an outsider to watching people do wrestling, it doesn't affect me as much. Okay, sorry we're going long. Royal Rumble, I have it second out of 34. What an amazing Rumble from start to finish. I think this is easily the best booked Rumble since 2010. And I guess because I have it second, the best Rumble since 1992. The storytelling in this one is fantastic, and the Philadelphia crowd is incredible. I mean, they treat The Miz like a king. The Miz. It's balls-to-wall action the whole time. Finn Balor is a fantastic Iron Man. Does a great job. And he and Rusev carry the really early stages of the match, which is great. Everyone in the match has a purpose. The comedy is kept to a minimum. I like everyone beating on Heath Slater. And then he finally gets to eliminate Sheamus. Then Nakamura comes in, and it is on. To me, besides his debut, this is the only time we get the real Nakamura. He is everywhere in the match. Rey Mysterio is a wonderful surprise entrant at 27. The place comes unglued. The final six of Cena, Orton, and Rey versus Roman, Balor, and Nakamura is such a cool story of old versus new. And then it comes down to Cena, Reigns, and Nakamura, right? And you think, you don't think they're going to do it. They're not going to give it to Nakamura. Like before this, what was the last satisfying Rumble winner? Like, I mean, universally satisfying, right? Because, I mean, obviously everybody has their favorites. But was it Sheamus in 2012? Edge in 2010? Like, all this to say, their track record with pleasing the audience with their winners leaves a lot to be desired. Then Cena gets eliminated by Nakamura in a great sequence with the knee to the head, drops into the ground, and then we're down to Nakamura and Reigns. And I'd like to point out, Reigns by this point is the perfect late number entrant because we all just assume he's going to win, right? And, you know, he's 1-5 in Rumbles, but we still all assume he's going to win, and he's so good at that role, right? And I think it's down... Now, I think he should just be champion forever. But man, his aura of invincibility gets a lot out of the end of this match. Reigns misses the spear. Nat crushes him with the knee, picks him up, tosses him. Euphoria. This is the first Royal Rumble I watched with my son live. We were at a restaurant in Vancouver, and we shared the night, and it was great. He was happy. I was happy. It was a great moment. And despite their stupidity with Nakamura in 2017, they had him a new star again. A new megastar. The people loved him. And then we saw he could go 40 minutes. He could go. I guess it was a better choice to continue the listless AJ style run instead. All right. Historical importance, 16th out of 36. I mean, look, it's all on the women's division and their success because not a lot else happens, right? Except, you know, the one glaring thing. This is kind of like the year WWE went all in on the Saudi propaganda. And I mean, look, I get taking their money, all right? I'm not criticizing them for taking their money, right? That's business, right? But, you know, you could take their money and not jump on the propaganda train, right? And not tell us you're in the midst of a women's revolution when you're working with a country. Like, not a private industry, right? But you're working with a country that just allowed women to be able to drive. I mean, it's hard to say that Finn Balor is for everyone with the LGBTQ flag on his tights, but at the same time, you take money from a government that executes gay people. Look, I'm not a social activist at all, but it drove me crazy because there's a hypocrisy here, right? The company loves to praise themselves for every single cause they latch onto, right? But in the end, their values are about making money, which is fine. Then do that, right? Tell us you took the Saudi money because it's too much and you'd be crazy not to, right? Be honest. Don't bullshit us by saying, oh, we're going to change the culture there because you're not, right? And then you have this nonstop blitz about how feminist your company is. And like, you can't have it both ways. It's scummy when you do it, right? We know who you are, WWE. You're a capitalist company who will take money from anyone. You're a giant bully in the wrestling industry, right? If you didn't fucking paint yourself as some sort of transcendent social change company who's the victim of others, no one would have as much a problem with this money. All right. SummerSlam, 24 out of 34. It's below average and extremely long. The strongest match on the card is a triple threat between Carmella, Charlotte, and Becky. And while the match itself is fine, it's the turn that's memorable. Harper and Rowan use their giant hammers in an altercation with the New Day. Again, it's fine. AJ Styles and Samoa Joe have a 3-star match for the WWE title. And if you're happy with a 3-star match from these guys, I think you're either happy with anything or you've lowered your expectations to a point where both guys, if they just have a coherent match without any bullshit or Michael Cole screaming about the numbers game, you'll be pleased. that might be the better position. Shinsuke and Jeff Hardy fight for the U.S. title. It just doesn't matter. Daniel Bryan's year-long feud with The Miz finally gets a payoff, and it's a decent match. You wish they would have given them more time and energy, but, you know, the rematch the next month with the non-wrestlers is probably more important. Ziggler gets his yearly shot at something he didn't deserve. It's just a replay of 2016 where Ziggler, but it's with the Intercontinental this time. Even if he'd won it here, we know that 2 years later he's going to be given a title shot out of nowhere too, because that's just what happens. You ever notice? That's what happened with Drew McIntyre. Out of nowhere, Ziggler gets a title shot, right? Every summer. You ever notice how, like, a three-year period, they give the same guys the title shots at the same time of year? Like, from 2017 to 2019, it was Samoa Joe getting title shots in the early summer, right? Why every year at that time? It's just Samoa Joe's time of year? Randy Orton got title shots from 2019 to 2020 in the late summer. Just because. I think it's because ultimately the company would like to just tell the same stories year after year and have the same beats every year too, so they don't ever have to write anything creative again. I can't think of another explanation. But it's June. It's June. It's time for Joe. Ronda Rousey wins the Raw Women's title at this SummerSlam. It's a really cool moment. Alexa was up for it, but she doesn't have the Raw fighting style or power the Horsewomen have. And as a result, the match just isn't as good. But it's still good. It's a great moment for Rousey. Despite the fact that she was dressed like she just filmed some sort of fuck fest for the movie Cats. Roman finally beat Brock, hooray. And the worst match is Braun killing Kevin Owens. So nothing overly horrible, nothing great either, just a show that happened. Let's deal with a show that happened, the worst show of the year, Crown Jewel. Just so you know, the other Saudi show is the second worst. And they're both far and away the worst. Crown Jewel wins this one for having the most matches of all time. And the DX and Brothers of Destruction contest. This was the disastrous World Cup. And since they decided to book a shitty tournament, it means we're bound to get a bunch of short, meaningless matches that are probably rushing through for time, right? And after this intense 8-man tournament, Miz needs to be replaced at the last minute by a completely fresh Shane McMahon, who would go on to beat Dolph Ziggler and claim the title of the best wrestler in the world. This led to the incredible team of Miz and Shane McMahon as the best tag team in the world and the interminable feud between Miz and Shane that included a 50-year-old man who has never, ever been in a fight before. Look, if you're one of these people who has a problem with Cody Rhodes getting screen time on Dynamite, despite, you know, being one of the most over people on the show, I hope you have the critical thinking skills necessary to realize that booking Shane McMahon in these roles is just as bad, or really worse. The high point of this Crown Jewel is AJ defending against, you guessed it, Samoa Joe. That's how long their feud lasted. Brock fights Braun. Why didn't they just make the tournament for the title since it was vacant? In abeyance. Excuse me. I just find another way to get to Shane and Miz. The whole tournament was to get to Shane and Miz. Why even do that? Oh, it's because they wrote it down on paper? I guess you should probably not change that. Then four Hall of Famers went out and sullied their legacies. Kane couldn't even keep his mask on. Fuck, man. Oh, terrible. Best show of the year. Before we do that, Tyler Kelly. 2018 dawned with a renewed hope, starting with a strong Rumble due to a very good men and women's Rumble matches and the debut of Ronda Rousey, who was smiling, sign-pointing sensation. Speaking of Rousey, her in-ring debut came in a fun mixed tag match at WrestleMania, which looked to be great after excellent early matches, then settled into good after both title matches disappointed to varying degrees. Great. Okay, Daniel Bryan made his in-ring debut at Mania, and he continues having great matches to this day. Rousey had a very impressive rookie year, and 2018 saw the rise of Becky Lynch and the all-women Evolution pay-per-view, delivering on the promise of the women's revolution, which is a registered trademark of Stephanie McMahon. I don't recall anything else but the main roster pay-per-views from 2018. But what really stood out and no doubt carried 2018 to this lofty spot on your list, Mr. George, has to be NXT. Johnny Gargano and Andrade Cien Almas had an all-timer at TakeOver Philadelphia. And others, and as others have mentioned, TakeOver New Orleans is an all-time show for any promotion. I thought the Gargano Ciampa feud was fantastic in all three TakeOver matches. The North American title ladder match for the New Orleans was a classic. The Undisputed Era was tearing up the tag title scene. Their match with Mustache Mountain at Brooklyn 4 was incredible, though not as good as their TV match earlier. And Ricochet was smoking in the mid-card. Yeah, Tyler. Guys, give Tyler some love. He does all the work for the Place to Be Nation stretch project, which is the greatest WCW match of all time. Go check that out. Go to placetobenation.com. Search greatest WCW match of all time. It's all due to Tyler's tireless work, so please show him some love. The best show of the year, like he mentioned, TakeOver New Orleans. I will say the top four shows of the year are all takeovers, and no, the only other takeover that finishes eighth. I wish I had more of a connection to this show. It's clearly one of the best they've ever done. Again, if you're one of these people who thinks Dave Meltzer hates the WWE or is in AEW's payroll, I'll point to the fact that he gave 2 5-star ratings on this show, which is the first time he'd ever done that for a North American show. Look, the ladder match that opens the show is incredible. I keep going. I mentioned earlier, I keep going back. Is it the greatest ladder match of all time? Because it feels like it. It feels like it should be ahead of the tag team ladder matches from 2000 and 2001. And not only is the new In Abeyance North American title on the line, but it has all the exact right people in it. But how can I call it the greatest ladder match of all time with Lars Sullivan and EC3 in it? The rest, though, are studs. Cole is the glue. The most over guy who holds it all together. Killian Dane is a great base and a beast. Velveteen's there to take all the stupid bumps, which he does. And then there's Ricochet. Oh, man. Best high, I mentioned it. Best high flyer I've ever seen. I remember when Andrade wanted to leave, people were like, why? Why does he want to do that? And it's like, if you're a high-level athlete like Ricochet and Andrade, do you want to burn away years of your athletic prime sitting around doing nothing, right? I don't think it's unreasonable to want to go somewhere else if you're not being used. And it's insane they can't find a good spot for him. Shayna Baszler started her NXT Women's Division Championship win by beating Ember Moon. I love that it played on their story from Philadelphia, where Ember had her arm destroyed. Undisputed Era finally all came together as Roddy Strong turned on Pete Dunne. This gave the Undisputed Era the tag titles they retained and the Dusty Rhodes Classic tournament win. Black won the title from Almas. Gets no love. It's a great match. And the main event, Ciampa and Gargano is incredible. I think it's the best of their series. Everything else is diminishing returns, albeit very small diminishing returns. I love the finish with a knee brace in the face and the Gargano escape. Great emotional payoff. But you could take any of the takeovers and they might be the best match of the year. It's easily. I'm sorry this is a supersized edition. Like, it's just there's so much happening in the year. Okay, 5 worst wrestlers of the year. 5, Nia Jax. Her best matches are against Ronda Rousey. And even then, I would argue the first one's actually pretty good. I'll also not be a dick and say it was all due to Rousey. I think Nia held up her end well. So here's my theory on Nia. I think she has trouble controlling her body movements, which is why all her stuff looks sloppy and out of place. You can see that she doesn't move right on the leg drop. There's something to do with maybe there's a cognitive problem where she's having trouble controlling her body. But that's actually what I think is the problem with her. Brock Lesnar is number 4. And this one hurts because if you follow this podcast at all, I consider Brock to be one of the greatest talents of all time. But this is just not his year. Now, it doesn't help that he's in a dead-end feud with Reigns for most of the year. And the rest of the time he's saddled with Braun. But obviously, his best matchup with Bryan at Survivor Series. But his other defenses are in the triple threat with Kane, Braun at the Rumble. The matches with Roman were fine at Mania and SummerSlam, but they wouldn't place among their best. Sadly, Brock has to fight in Saudi Arabia. This definitely hurts him. The cage match with Reigns is boring. The stupid finish with the cage didn't help. Oh, and by the way, Reigns did hit the ground first. Doesn't make sense with their stupid logical minds. And the Saudi match with Braun is trash. My favorite Brock Lesnar thing of the year was the company trying to get over that the narrative that Brock didn't care about the business as part of the storyline heading into SummerSlam. That's how desperate they are to get Roman cheered. They decide to shit over on their biggest investment of the last decade. The crazy thing, it worked. I saw people out of nowhere saying, you know what? I don't like when the champion's not there, right? Despite the fact that this has never been a problem for them ever before. But WWE makes it a story, so now we got to go with it, right? We've known forever he doesn't care about the business. And who fucking cares as long as he's good at it, which he is. But if you suddenly believe he's bad because the WWE tells you to, then you're the fucking biggest possible mark, right? You probably think Undertaker's parents died in a fire and Al Wilson was fucked to death. All right, 3, Alexa Bliss. I don't want to shit on Alexa. I just think she wasn't put in the best position to succeed. She's fine in multi-women matches. She's good with Rousey, but can't do anything with Nia. It's not her fault. Nia should be here. 2, Carmella. As much as I love the Carmella character, I think the matches leave a little to be desired. And it's a testament to how strong the year was with Alexa and Carmella landing lower on this list. Because it's not like they don't deserve to be higher. Worst rest of the year, Lashley. What a weird choice, right? But I think it becomes obvious when you think about the fact that I've barely mentioned him this whole show. All the guys in the big shit show matches don't qualify for these awards. So you need to be in a quarter of the shows, and there's 20. So no doubt, the poor Undertaker, if he'd wrestle one more time, he'd walk away with this category. But instead, here's a guy they brought in with deserved fanfare and did nothing with him. The only match that breaks three stars with him is a Survivor Series match with nine other guys in it. He's not good with Rollins. He's not good with Reigns. He's not good with Sami Zayn. He's not good in the team with Braun against Sami and Owens. The worst of all was team up with Kung Fu John Cena against Owens and Elias. Why do they do that to the good people of Australia? All right, let's deal with the five best wrestlers of the year. And then let's get out of here. All right, so I'm going to say that number five is Becky Lynch, right? She does such a good job all year. I've talked about her, at length as we go on. But the fact that she really caught on with the zeitgeist is really something special. She did so well, exactly the right time. Her matches are universally great across the board. And she's the most important women's wrestler not named Ronda Rousey. Number four, despite the fact that the year that Becky had, number four, Charlotte Flair. And in a year that's all about women's success, I'm really happy we get to talk about her and Becky. There's for sure an argument to be made that Charlotte's the most complete women's wrestler of all time. And as much as I like Becky, besides being over, I think Charlotte kind of tops her at everything. That being said, being over actually might be more important than all that. But Charlotte's year is great. Her peak is with Becky at Evolution and Hell in a Cell. But I think she has the best match at WrestleMania, in my opinion, with Asuka. And she kills it with Ronda at the Survivor Series. Your mileage can vary with the triple threats with Bayley and... With Becky and Carmella, and then later with Becky and Asuka. But I think at baseline, they're very good. Her worst match clocks in at 2.5 stars for me. And it's really because her opponent, Ruby Riott, just doesn't really have the credibility to be in there with her. Charlotte, for me, feels like just the perfect final boss for the women's division. Because it actually means something to beat her, which is incredibly rare in modern WWE. Number three, Velveteen Dream. I talked about how great he was. All of his matches tell a cool story. The character clicks. He's fucking over. He's a great part of the ladder match at New Orleans. He has an excellent match with Ciampa for the next NXT title at War Games. His match with Ricochet is great. He even managed to pull a decent match out of EC3 of all people. His low point, if you can call it that, is Cassius Ohno in Philadelphia. But even that's very good. I love that he vowed to knock him out for inside a minute and then almost succeeded. When he hits him with that blow at the start, the crowd goes crazy, right? Just a great year from the Dream. And this could be a major wasted potential guy. And I wouldn't actually put it at the company's feet. But I will add him to the pile of guys that do belong to be at the company's feet. All right. Then I have a three-way tie at second. Adam Cole. I've talked about how great he is. AJ Styles. So imagine AJ having a year-long title reign and it being this disinteresting, right? It's a shame. It feels like if you were to look at his opponents, you'd be like, wow, this is going to be an all-time year. And then it's disappointing. But he's got four-star matches. He carried the title well. I think we're just spoiled with AJ. And also tied for number two with Adam Cole and AJ Styles is Shinsuke Nakamura. And his story is very similar to AJ's, only he has the awesome Royal Rumble performance and a great match with Seth Rollins at the Survivor Series to prop him up a bit more. But a great year from the King of Strong Style. I don't know why they didn't want to go all the way with him. The package was there in 2018. They just didn't want to pull the trigger. The number one wrestler of 2018, Johnny Gargano. Five matches, all 4.5 stars or higher. Three getting great encounters with Ciampa, a great match with Black, and the match of the year with Andrade. It makes no sense. I don't want to see him anymore, but here we are. Nevertheless, the best wrestler in 2018 by a mile is Johnny Gargano. He delivers one of the best in-ring years in company history. I just wish I connected with him more. Justin Pratt, my thoughts on 2018 are summed up by the fact that I had to Google everything that happened. NXT had their last NXT-feeling year, in my opinion, and the main roster was pretty stale. Match for match, I can definitely see why this ranks high, though. Yeah, that's interesting. I think Johnny Gargano's better in the mid-card blood feud than he is as champion and challenging for the title. And I think that was the problem with 2019 going forward. All right, look, I've talked a lot. Thank you for sticking with me. 2018 in the books. Look, I'm sure you're surprised by the ranking. I know I was. Now, usually, I'll show you how high the years could have gone if they improved. Let's do the opposite for this one, right? Because it's carried solely on the backs of match quality, the Royal Rumble, and the women's division. So look, if it had just been like 10 points further back at each of those categories, which would still put it all in the top half, this year would have finished 21st. So in the bottom half of the ranking. I know I've mentioned it before, but I was trying to figure out how to rank these years, like, you know, when I was building the system, right? And I had a higher emphasis on match quality, but this was the year that kept winning. NXT makes such a huge difference here, but the women deserve the credit. I know in the past they've been hard in the Divas division, but this year the women were what I enjoyed watching most on the show. They were fantastic and in many ways earned that main event spot at WrestleMania 35 and earned the status of being just as good, if not better, than the men at times. The characters are great. The matches deliver. They are amazing. Next time on The Year That Was, the last modern era show that I have to deal with finishes ninth place. And it's a year as frustrating as it is incredible. See you then.